It's no secret that LGBT folks have had a profound influence on arts and culture, but they've also had a tremendous effect on scientific discovery, even though they've often had to hide who they were.
Today, we're joined by science journalist Vincent Gabriel to explore the lives of extraordinary LGBT scientists who changed the world. Listen as we take a look at why so many places are named after explorer Alexander von Humboldt.
George Washington Carver's flower power.
How Leonardo da Vinci almost went to jail for sodomy.
Why anthropologist Margaret Mead's work still enrages conservatives.
Astronaut Sally Ride's coming out from the grave.
How neuroscientist Ben Barnes came out as trans in response to sexism in academia.
And what the film Imitation Game got wrong about mathematician Alan Turing.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Not shaving gives me more time for misbehaving. Get this sexy t-shirt and all our fabulous designs at feastoffun.com/store.
Hello.
Hi, is this Vincent Gabriel?
This is.
Hi, this is Fausto Fernos.
And Mark Fillion from Feast of Fun. How are you today?
Doing pretty well.
Awesome. Good to hear.
Yeah.
I fell in love with your blog entry about Alexander von Humboldt.
Yeah, did it come across that Humboldt is essentially like a historical gay crush of mine?
Yeah,
a little bit. It was a little love letter to the past.
Yeah, I would. Humboldt would date if I saw him on Grindr. Be like, let's do it.
He was a good looking Prussian scientist, ecologist, and you're also a person who loves trees and paleobotany. Can you tell the audience a little bit about your background of like your interest in science history?
Yeah. So while I was in graduate school, I was doing the whole grad school thing and putting together a CV, and I was told that it was unprofessional to have an affiliation with an LGBT group listed on the resume because it was seen as unserious to be publicly out as a gay scientist.
Vincent, what was the field of study that you were working on?
Immunology. I was building vaccines, studying the interplay of the immune system and bacteria, basically.
Yeah, because HIV and gay people have nothing to do with each other.
No, they don't. Really don't. Gay people never get sick.
Well, there was a news article that just came out recently about these kids in high school. They show up at high school and they see a rainbow flag burned. And it said, gay guys die from AIDS more often. And it was like, well, I guess that is true, right? But back in the day, it would have just been like, gays die from AIDS. But things have changed.
Yeah, things have changed so much that the hate groups have revised their language to be
a little more correct, right?
Of random people who also get HIV.
And so what was the group you belonged to that they said it's not serious enough for what you're doing?
Well, I'm a writer and editor for Queerica.com. It's an LGBT feminist and skeptical group blog, and we talk about the intersection of science, pop culture, LGBT issues, and all of that stuff. I was putting that there as hey, I do a public facing science communication thing. Mm-hmm. And
Now you wrote this extraordinary article about Alexander von Humboldt. He's the founding father of ecology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Alexander von Humboldt is mostly known as a place name in the United States. If you drive around California or the Midwest or really anywhere that's not extensively already place named, the Northeast, you'll just find Humboldt stuff everywhere.
We have a Humboldt Park here in Chicago. It's the traditional Puerto Rican neighborhood.
Which is funny because that was actually named by German immigrants to the area after Humboldt, after years after he died. Yeah. I have an entire paragraph that's 500 words long of things that are named after Humboldt. It's hard to find something that hasn't been named after Humboldt. He has two asteroids. He has two asteroids, hotels, a mountain, a plane on the moon. The guy was very, very famous for it during his lifetime.
And he was famous because they call him the father of what, ecology? Is that what it is?
Yeah. So Humboldt is one of the founding fathers of ecology. He spent 5 years exploring South America at the behest of the then Spanish king, Charles IV of Spain. Mm-hmm. This is like at the height of the Spanish Renaissance. So the Spaniards were really late to the boat because they were kind of conservative about Renaissance things. When they bit down on it, they're like, oh, here's this famous Prussian geologist and mine inspector. Maybe he'll find us more gold deposits. And Humboldt was like, no, I'm taking my friend Ami Bonpland, who's a French botanist, and I'm going to travel for 5 years through the New Spain.
What was his relationship with Ami, the French doctor?
Unfortunately, those two aren't actually that kind of relationship. They weren't involved with each other. At least all the evidence points to them not being involved with each other. They were very close friends and colleagues. Ami and Humboldt collected thousands and thousands of plant samples on their journey and took extensive measurements everywhere they went. They basically developed the idea that by measuring basically everything from like atmospheric pressure to temperature to the color of the sky, that you could develop an integrated view of the landscape, right? And the notion that like precipitation, temperature, elevation, all these things have an impact on the watershed and an impact on what plants and animals can live where.
He developed the concept of the habitat. And of course, you know, going like school in the United States, we learn about habitat and it just seems kind of commonplace. You know, you look at like an otter, its habitat is the river and this is what it eats and that kind of thing. And its relationship to each other. And he's the guy that came up with it.
Well, I mean, kind of. He came up with the idea of ecoregions, climate regions. It's slightly larger in an ecological context than habitat. Habitat's just like a very local spot where an animal or plant lives. An ecoregion is an interrelated set of like geochemical, biological, and physical things that give rise to the conditions that let species thrive in an area. It was actually because of his study into ecology and his development of this interrelatedness of living things with the environment that he figured out that humans were actually causing environmental decay. He witnessed widespread deforestation and really bad ecological practices that were being perpetuated in New Spain by Spanish officials. And he linked them to decline in local health, watershed health. He's basically the first person to link human activity to climate change and to the degradation of the land around people.
And Alexander von Humboldt also was I call him the first Carl Sagan.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because he actually wrote a book called Cosmos.
Yeah, he wrote a book called Cosmos with a K because German language. Cosmos is like 7 volumes and it's engraved. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And he spent basically the rest of his life writing the book after this expedition. Every edition outsold Napoleon's book that came out roughly at the same time. That was the result of a collaboration of like 1,000 or so scholars that he imported with him while he was conquering North Africa. So Napoleon was really pissed off at Humboldt because Humboldt alone was outselling Napoleon's
his works.
Yeah.
And like Carl Sagan caused the von Humboldt Cosmos was sort of a global view of science and life and its interconnectedness.
Cosmos is a book rich with like the connectivity of life and the environment. There's stuff in there about like keystone species, the first observation of keystone species by a scientist. In that, like, in the Andean foothills, in the Llanos grasslands, animal life relies on the presence of the Muirtania palm. Without the palm, you don't get certain species in a region. You don't get communities of animals in a region. And so the biodiversity of that area is diminished. That's one of the things that was one of the revelations that was published in this book. It seems really obvious now, but its obviousness is because most science in that field afterwards has been based on these observations.
And Alexander von Humboldt was somebody who was independently wealthy, and maybe part of his interest in traveling and doing this sort of humanitarian science was because it got him out of the house and got him to meet some interesting people that he possibly may have had sex with.
I mean, possibly and probably, but also he was just sort of driven to do this sort of thing from a young age. His parents' nickname for him was the Little Apothecary, because at the family home, he would just run off into the woods and gather plants and then press them and draw them and do all this stuff with them. He used to tend a garden as a child. Like, he did a lot of exploratory things that drove his staid Prussian family crazy, because he was always out in the wilderness gathering things.
He reminds me a lot of George Washington Carver, who another gay scientist who spent much of his life like talking to the plants and collecting them and listening to the flowers.
That is a through line for both of these two, in that, like, from a young age, they're just sort of driven to do this. It's only like Humboldt's family, and like most specifically his mother, who drive him to do the mine inspector route in Prussia, because it was a good middle class job. And she's like, "My God, Humboldt, stop gathering plants and go to school." So
get a job.
Stop traveling Europe with random botanists and go become a miner.
Well, he fell in love with a lot of the people that he worked with. Francisco José de Caldas. He wrote all these love letters to him, and he's like, "Hey, buddy, I was just, you know, trying to be friendly. Don't give me a reach around."
And there's actually evidence that he had a romantically inclined traveling companion while he was in New Spain, because he was dealing with among not just Bompa land, but he was dealing with local people.
Are you talking about Johann Seriphert?
So while he was traveling, he made the acquaintance of Francisco José de Caldas. Mm-hmm. He's a Colombian naturalist and scientist. But Francisco was far more religious than Humboldt, and did not approve of his random dalliances with local people. He had a young traveling companion that Francisco references in some of his letters, and I couldn't find this person's name. It's probably lost to history.
Because you were researching all this stuff to write this article. It's not like a lot of his family and a lot of his love letters were destroyed or erased or buried or hidden.
Yeah. And he, mm-hmm. I mean, some of these things do remain. There is some amorous correspondence with childhood friends, in, you know, essentially high school. And there's some correspondence with later companions. Certain authors have characterized these as Prussian romanticism, because there's Prussia had a very homoerotic boarding school and male schooling culture at the time. But I mean, on top of that, you have Humboldt, who never marries, who's scaring away religious companions with his associations with young men, and who eventually embarks on a long-term relationship with his valet.
And that's Johann.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's much later. That's actually in 1827.
And back in the day, they used to be able to, you know, you'd hire somebody, you'd say you'd hire your lover as your valet, because that's an easy way to explain why you're living with this man.
So if Mark and I were in the 1800s, I would have said Mark is my valet, or I was Mark's valet, and we're exploring the universe.
Yeah, that'd be a very good way to hide your intense passions for each other. He's just dressing me in my bedroom. He's just he's not undressing me.
And so it's interesting, because recently in the musical Hamilton by Lin-Manuel Miranda, there's been some controversy in the sense that the legacy of these men who or women who had same-sex affections in the past you know, they're very debated. George Washington Carver's sexual identity is debated, hotly debated. Alexander Hamilton, was he in love with Lawrence or were they just close friends? And certainly with Humboldt, that phenomenon still occurs, right? In trying to write about LGBT science and history, it's a very challenging thing because you're sort of having to read between the lines in these love letters, and that's really the only kind of documentation you have because they didn't really identify as gay at the time anyways.
Yeah, they didn't have that word. Just after Humboldt's death in Prussia, there's actually the first documented case of a gay rights movement. There was a group that was trying to strike down that infamous paragraph, quote unquote, that forbade male on male consensual sex and relationships. So he never actually lived to see a point where he could openly be himself. And that movement was squashed by the Nazis in 1934, following the rise of the Third Reich. So it's not as if they managed to survive that history.
Is it 250 years ago that he lived, right? So we're dealing with also sort of the world turning its back on German history and this extraordinary, loving, peaceful man, Alexander von Humboldt, was, you know, speaking out against slavery, talking about ecology, talking to the flowers. This lovely person is mostly largely forgotten because of the fact that we sort of associate, you know, horrific images with German culture.
Yes, that's definitely part of it. Germans in America following World War II forcibly assimilated themselves. They stopped speaking the language. German cultural associations declined, and so we're left with place names that they've named, and we're left with family names, and we're left with Humboldt decorating places in America, and most people just don't know why.
What's because he traveled around. Let's move on to talking about George Washington Carver, who to me is such a colorful, both literally and figuratively, person.
I don't want to describe him as colorful. Like colorful. Yeah, that's really.
Well, because, and this is, I explained this to a lot of people, is that his work in biochemistry and sort of laid the foundation for pigments. He would develop different kinds of paints and go to people's barns and say, hey, can I paint your barn to see how well this paint resists the weather? And as a pioneer in biochemistry, we sort of have all these colors today, literally a rainbow, because of the work of men like George Washington Carver.
Yes. So you lure people in with the terrible joke, and then you hook them with the historical facts.
Hook them on science.
Yes. Get them. I got you with science. Well, I mean, he was an extraordinary life. He was born a slave. He was kidnapped around. For some point in time, he lived with a pagan mystic, and that's where he picked up his love for nature.
I didn't hear anything about a pagan mystic when I was researching him, but I do know when he was an infant, George and his mother were kidnapped by bandits, taken to Arkansas, and he was ransomed for a horse, which was valued at $300, but he would never heard from his mother again. He was returned to the plantation that he was born, the plantation of Moses and Susan Carver in Missouri, where he grew up. He was actually fascinated with nature as a child. Susan Carver, the wife of the man who owned the plantation, talked about him having a peculiar gift for nurturing plants, and he became sort of famous in that area, Diamond, Missouri, as a plant doctor, because he had this knack for dealing with plants and diagnosing plants and helping plants grow, which is, you know, immensely important in an agricultural region.
Well, it is because he was raised by the slave owners of his mother. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then as a teenager, because they were sort of like wanted to get him out of, you know, they didn't see him as a son. He went to live with other people, and that's where he picked up his love for nature.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the slave owners instilled in him his love. I'm saying that, like, he grew up there And it was mentioned in memoirs that were dug up, or diaries that were dug up from that plantation, because he was of historical note. They didn't just seek them out apropos of nothing.
Now, Mark and I are very, very fascinated by this newsreel where he's accepting an award. And in it, he and I'm going to do my best impersonation of him.
Oh, please.
He has a very high voice that kind of breaks, and he says, "I'm not sure I am worthy of this splendid citation, but I wish to say that also I thank you from the depths of my heart." And we were like, holy cow, the peanut guy was gay. That's how we discovered that he was gay. We're like, oh my God.
He sounds gay.
He sounds gay, right? And so we started researching all this stuff and found out that he was like living at Tuskegee College with Austin Wingate Curtis Jr., who was like 20 years younger, and they slept in the same bed together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that happened. He actually left. He left that particular person his royalties for his books that he had sold, which were immensely valuable. He also didn't have anybody else to leave anything to. It was because of the inheritance and it being so contentious that his boyfriend was released from the school, was removed from the school, because the school also wanted to receive that inheritance, mm-hmm. but they didn't approve the relationship.
Yeah, you know, but here's a man though too that throughout his lifetime, like, he never patented anything. He gave away all of his information. He was offered very lucrative jobs, but he wanted to stay at the school because he thought, like, what I do benefits everyone.
He wrote cookbooks. Yeah. How to make a sweet potato pie recipe was came from him.
Yeah, all of his work was very public facing. Well, most of his work was very public facing, and most of his work was like deliberately left open for people to use. The only thing I could find of his that was more like hard science and something that like average farmers and sharecroppers wouldn't necessarily understand was his extensive cataloging of fungal pathogens, fungus-based diseases of crops. He cataloged like 1,000 of them. And he was thought of as one of the premier mycologists of his era. Yeah, I'm just tripping over my tongue because I'm not used to this whole talking on record.
I think it's great that be able to chat about this with you because in researching stuff for this show. George Washington Carver, because he's such an important figure in both biochemistry and in Black History Month, yes. There's a lot of controversy to this day of whether he was gay or not, whether he was castrated.
It's unlikely he was castrated.
But a lot of people saying that the reason that he had a gay sissy voice, first the excuse they came up with is he was castrated. Then they said it was the whooping cough that he had as a kid. But and then other people started pointing out is like, well, he had secondary male traits like facial hair. So had he been castrated or had been sickly as a child, he
wouldn't have facial hair.
It may not explain the way that he sounded.
And what about all those hot peanut oil massages he would offer to students?
all of the wrestling with students and the massages he was giving people and the not really dealing with women ever in a romantic way. That kind of says to me that he was probably gay and probably very closeted about it. I mean, he was the most prominent Black scientist in the Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. He was like the spokesman for the peanut lobby at a time when it was intensely unusual to see a Black person in public life. Mm-hmm. Like there's just no way that you can risk exposure in that circumstance.
He spoke in Congress and he was sort of like ridiculed and laughed at.
Yeah, especially initially because they just were not used to seeing an African American in Congress. Like the Southern senators specifically were just agog at it, like it was a circus performance. Mm.
Well, and, you know, and he liked him young and he liked him white, right? Because the guy that he left his royalties to was like a guy in his 20s, right? And he's a white guy. But I guess he had also fallen in love with somebody else named Jim Hardwick, who was like some kind of evangelist, and he was 23 years old. But and so he was actually in a love triangle with this guy. But Jim was also seeing a woman. But in the end, he left both of them for another woman.
And then there was Henry Wallace. He also had a sort of a bromance with. Mm.
I actually didn't run into Henry Wallace in my research. I'm sorry.
he got around. This is the thing. It's like a man of such humble origins, he changed the face of biochemistry. The Soviet Union offered him to go to the Soviet Union to help them raise crops.
Yes.
This was unprecedented. It just blows my mind because here we're living in a world at this time period where just racism is so toxic. It's so fresh. It's so thick. You can cut it with a knife. And the world just fell in love with this man.
Yeah, he was admitted to the Royal Society of London, which was also, you know, unheard of. He was admitted to the National Academy of Sciences. He was, you know, this massive national and international figure in science that at a time when that was like crazy for a former slave in the Jim Crow South to do that. And that's primarily why he's so important.
Not for his cookbooks, no. Which I actually I looked at the cookbooks hoping I'd get some good recipes out of it, but they're very like, you know, how to make pancakes or it's very like things that we take for granted today. I guess at the time period was like vital information that people just didn't know what to do.
Mm. Well, people were very isolated, you know, and so if you didn't read, if you didn't write, how are you going to get information? It's only going to be pretty much through word of mouth.
Yeah. And there's also, you know, sometimes there's just deliberate keeping of people in ignorance. Most of his work was done to benefit sharecroppers, people who were former slaves who were trapped in a horrifying tenement farming situation, a perpetual debt. And his like recommendations for crop rotation, they had never been taught crop rotation. They were like forced to cash farm for their livelihoods, both the detriment of their health and the detriment of the soil. And so that's why you plant peanuts. That's why you plant alternative crops. You need to put nitrogen back in the soil. You need to have places where you're not cultivating pests for cotton and other cash crops, right? Bollweevil was a huge problem at that time. And he, you know, helped develop and breed a bollweevil resistant crop. Like you just, there's a number of logistical and biological issues that come with being a farmer. And if you are kept in perpetual ignorance because you're in a basically new slavery situation.
Now, those are my favorite quotes of George Washington Carver when he was asked, why do you always carry a flower in a suit jacket in the buttonhole?
Oh my gosh.
And he said that it's the flowers that revealed the secrets of the universe to him. He said,
you know what? That sounds like a very George Washington Carver thing to say.
He says, how do I talk to a little flower? Through it, I talk to the infinite. And what is the infinite? It is the silent, small force. It isn't the outer physical contact. No, it is not that. The infinite is not confined in the visible world. It is not in the earthquake, the wind, nor the fire. It is that still small voice that calls up the fairies.
Aww.
He was so colorful. He was a painter. He was a musician. He was a cook. He was a
he was a Leonardo da Vinci. He was basically Leonardo da Vinci in like 1912.
Who was also Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, sorry, in 1941. Yeah, Leonardo da Vinci was also gay. Yeah, sorry.
What's the knowledge that we have about Leonardo da Vinci? Like besides the Da Vinci Code,
he went to jail for sodomy, right?
On Leonardo da Vinci, like his. Like, as for, like, his relationships, he was once publicly accused of sodomy and nearly tried for it in the 1400s in Florence, at a time when sodomy was a hangable death penalty offense. He was never actually brought to trial because of a legal problem in Florence where you needed to sign the affidavit claiming that someone was committing sodomy, and they just never signed it. So after that herring brush with the law, it appears that Leonardo went kind of quiet as to his relationships, but he probably practiced, undercover in the semi-permissive culture of Florence. Florence was known as a very gay place in the Renaissance, to the point where Germans called gay people Florenzi, basically, mm-hmm. You're from Florence, therefore you are gay.
So it was like the San Francisco of its time.
Yeah, it was the San Francisco of its time, but if the church caught you, you would be killed. Like 3,000 people were executed in Florence for the crime of sodomy.
Wow.
It was as tolerant as the Renaissance in Europe got. So Leonardo da Vinci kept himself fairly private for good reason, but sometimes you see it in his artwork, like in St. John the Baptist. St. John looks kind of erotically depicted. And there's a few other examples in his art where, like, the men are just kind of more in focus than others. But it's one of those things where you have to really, like, pair into, like, the male gaze in art. And that's kind of a squishy piece of evidence.
And everybody knows about Da Vinci's Last Supper and the Mona Lisa and... he also was an investigator of an extreme range of topics of botany, aerodynamics. He created a lot of prototypes that later led to the airplane.
It's really hard to summarize Da Vinci's life. the guy was a crazy polymath. He basically dipped his hands into everything.
But wasn't Alexander von Humboldt and also George Washington Carver men of many skills? Like, and part of it, I think, when we think about our sexual orientation, living in a world where we're sort of at odds with it, the fact that they use their unique perspective in the world to get out there to escape the limitations that they were facing. Their sexual identity or experience or desire was very much tied to this idea of becoming the masters of many different types of disciplines.
You could definitely make that argument.
Like today, like the people that we run into doing this podcast that are sort of like that is a lot of transgender women who are literally like good at 600 different types of diverse skills. Mm. And in academia and in science today, you're really sort of taught to specialize and not really encourage. In fact, you're penalized for diversifying like that.
Well, I mean, that's also just a function of the nature of research. Like when you're asking really, really specific questions with your experiments, because that's what an experiment is. It's a way of addressing a question that you have for reality. It tends to breed tons of specialization because the parameters of your question get more and more specific, right? So like when say, if I were doing an experiment in immunology, I'd be like, okay, what proteins are interacting with stimulator of interferon genes protein at like the moment of activation? And it's like, okay,
like ask ourselves that question like, all the time.
We do. I mean, every day I walk down the street and I talk to this guy in the corner, and he's just like, what's Sting doing? And I'm like, he's a musician, but he's also a protein. And then I skip away.
So what about the women? Certainly like, I love that you, Sally Ride, the famous astronaut, much like Nell Carter, was in a long-term relationship with a woman and was only sort of outed, after her death.
Yeah. Sally Ride, is another case of someone who, maintained her privacy about her relationship with Dr. Tam O'Shaughnessy for basically 30 years, for 27 years. She only basically gave permission to publicly talk about Dr. O'Shaughnessy as her you know, partner well into her battle with cancer at a birthday party. Mm-hmm. So she was very private about it. That's partially due to her being kind of a private person, but that's also partially because NASA's culture at the time was kind of a bro culture. In interviews, Sally Ride talks about getting like really weird questions from engineers about like makeup and like period products, women's hygiene products that she'd mm-hmm. need to take with her.
Well, there was an argument of why women shouldn't go into space is because their menstrual periods would go crazy or something, right?
There was a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's like, so she was dealing with, you know, breaking a barrier for mm-hmm. women. Mm-hmm. So like outing herself in a intensely masculine, intensely heteronormative, formerly military test pilot culture was just something that wasn't quite in the cards for her. Well, especially also, given her upbringing as like, you know, fairly quiet and not, you know, outgoing in that way.
Well, and her relationship with Dr. O'Shaughnessy too, it was, you know, they were, you know, partners, but also they were also partners in like an education program that they ran together, teaching science to young girls especially. And I think
they founded a company called Sally Ride Science. Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a porno.
It's really not very pornographic. Like it's a children's science education company. It doesn't really.
I think that's part of the reason also too why they remained in the closet as well is because they were dealing with kids and they knew that they would probably come up against some very conservative people, and for them that would become an issue for them when really all they want to do is educate these young people about science
and astronomy.
Yeah, and astronomy. Dr. O'Shaughnessy actually is an education psychologist specialist, too. Mm. So her entire career revolves around analyzing, studying, and optimizing how to teach children. Mm. So it's
so,
already...
So they sort of came forward at once Sally had passed on and Tam O'Shaughnessy was sort of retired?
It was in her obituary, right?
That's
how she was outed.
Yeah, in her obituary, she gave permission to have this done, but in her obituary, Sally Ride's sister actually talked about how Sally Ride was in this relationship with Dr. O'Shaughnessy. And then Dr. O'Shaughnessy talked about it in interviews later.
They asked her, do you cry when your equipment malfunctions?
Yeah, what did she say to ridiculous. That? She was just like, no. Like she was very like direct to the point.
Well,
like,
I'll tell you what, a lot of people were crying when the Challenger disaster exploded, and she was the person responsible for discovering why it exploded in the first place, right?
Yes. Sally, Dr. Ride, actually was able to suss out that the O-ring caused the failure. She had a good enough relationship with all the engineers involved that she could like get all the test specs. And she went through all the test specs and very quietly revealed it to the rest of the panel. She never took credit for it. It was only revealed posthumously in the oral history of the Challenger disaster when people involved in the investigation were interviewed. She passed it up the chain, didn't take credit. And they tried to correct the problem later, but it didn't actually work for the Columbia because that was a different mechanical failure. Mm-hmm. She also served on the Columbia disaster investigative team, and she's the only person to have served on both teams for the shuttle disasters, which is kind of a sobering and dubious honor, but it's definitely something that's worth noting.
Well, gosh, you know, in the 80s as kids, God, O-rings were everywhere, you know? Like, yeah. Right? I mean, do you remember that as a kid? It's just like, oh,
no,
those O-rings.
I'm going to reveal my age. I was born in 89. Oh. So all of my memories of 1980 don't exist.
Like, well, like kids, you know, freaking out or getting like mm-hmm. spooked out and scared about the events of September 11th. For me, it was the Challenger disaster, the explosion that was like we went home early from school that day.
Yeah, I was let out of homeschool early from 9/11, so it's
Columbia was a little different, though, too. And from what I understand, when Columbia went out into space, they knew that that piece was missing. Like, cause I guess they lost a piece from the front, and they knew that upon entry, it would
fall apart, that it would blow
up. And they just didn't say anything to them and allowed them to just kind of continue their mission without, you know, because they knew they were going to die. So they're like, well, why even bother telling them?
Yeah, that's kind of a sad and screwed up thing to find out.
You know, couldn't you go to the Russian space station or something like that?
Yeah,
you know?
Look at what in that movie Gravity.
Shit, The Martian, whatever, like all that. Yeah, you know,
we're gonna science the shit out of this.
Yeah, except we're you know not in a movie, so it's really difficult to fix things.
what was the star of the movie Gravity? I'm blanking on her name now.
Sandra Bullock, I think. Yeah.
If Sandra Bullock was on that flight, they would have all gone home in one piece. I mean, couldn't they've gotten inside some Russian space capsule that was floating around somewhere? I mean
they, in order to do that, you have to know there's a problem with your ship to begin with.
Yeah, but it's so weird that they just felt like they were expendable and they just wanted to see if it blew up or not.
Well, I think they knew it would blow up, and they were just like, we don't want to tell them because, you know, it'll ruin all the science that's going on.
But
I don't want to
science the shit out of
their
it
day.
I wonder if it was a question of like negligence and like underestimating the risk of failure in the event of that becoming a problem, right? Like, I have a feeling that the people of NASA don't intentionally send people to die on spaceships. I feel like that reentry crash, that burn up in the atmosphere, was something that they thought the shuttle could handle. And they didn't realize how bad it would eventually get.
Let's move on.
I'm giving NASA some credit here because I would rather like assume that they're competent and not evil.
It is NASA, and listen, Stranger Things. You know, there's science behind that.
Stranger Things is like some like occult department of like energy. Right. Like, if the Department of Energy comes out and it's like, yeah, we've been using psychic children for nukes, I'd be like, I could buy that, maybe.
Well, there was a conspiracy story about that led to the writers to create the series Stranger Things. Let's move on and talk about Margaret Mead, the cultural anthropologist who was very controversial for her work.
She was very controversial, but mostly after she passed. But she did do so much and was so publicly outspoken that she definitely caused controversies while she was alive.
What was she most famous for? What kind of idea that was hard for people to accept?
So Margaret Mead's most well-known contribution to anthropology was her PhD dissertation work, Coming of Age in Samoa and the Social Organization of the Manua, published in 1928 and 1930, respectively. The widespread popular assumption at that time was that race was responsible for culture. And Margaret Mead's work was one of the largest and most potent challenges to that assumption, arguing that social-cultural context, i.e. nature, not nurture, not nature, sorry, had more of an impact than biology. Basically, she conducted a 9-month-long cross-sectional survey of the lives of 63 Samoan girls from the Manua people. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm probably butchering it. So if you get angry Samoans calling you later, I'm sorry. Just direct them to my email.
Yes, please leave a voicemail.
Yeah, please leave a voicemail to tell us how bad at pronouncing things I am.
So she was sort of the voice against eugenicists to the idea at the time that, you know, because you had a big nose or you came from a different race, that somehow you would be predisposed to a life of crime, for example.
Well, I mean, it wasn't so much the eugenics movement the eugenicists sort of in like 4 or 5 years would be thoroughly discredited by their association with Nazi Germany. 1934 is when they came to power in Germany. And then so you'll have eventually that reckoning happen. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But there's still a very strong racial assumption for culture. Right. Like people like it's so bad that people like literally categorize people's like civilization status by their race. Mead didn't buy this idea, and neither did her PhD dissertation advisor, who is one of the founders of American Anthropology, who I've lost in my notes, which is frustrating. But Mead, her study was actually about whether or not adolescence was painful in every culture, because she experienced a very painful adolescence and a painful, you know, transition to adulthood. And she found that Samoan children actually experienced a comparably very smooth transition to adulthood. And that was groundbreaking for a number of reasons. One was just the immense field work that she was doing, right? That was something that anthropologists didn't usually do. Like, they would usually take records from, like, missionaries and use those notes to create their studies of other peoples. And she also used this cross-cultural comparison to highlight issues within Western society. So the way that young girls and young boys are treated in the West was different than it was in Samoa, and that can cause psychological issues. That was her primary contribution to literature. At least that was her big splash moment for anthropology. And then afterwards, she just kept on rolling. She literally never stopped writing.
And so what you're saying is that her anthropological work was based on direct evidence, as opposed to other work of the time that was based on missionary diaries.
Yeah, she was making direct observations. She was taking notes herself. She was conducting interviews with people, observing daily life, observing ritual, observing people as people are, which is, you know, important when you're studying people. I know it's shocking, but to study people, you kind of need to be.
Well, Margaret Mead influential to primatologists like Jane Goodall, who sort of famously lived amongst the apes for some time, and sort of there's this idea that if you really need to learn about something, you have to be there and not go through a secondary information.
I'm not sure if she was directly influenced by Margaret Mead. I feel like Jane Goodall
Diane Fossey.
Diane Fossey. And who was the third one? The one who did orangutans. There were three women all at the same time who were sponsored by Louis Leakey, one of the great anthropologists, primatologists, and scientists of his time. And he encouraged them to go into science, support their research efforts, and they studied the three great ape species, respectively. Jane Goodall with the chimpanzees, Fossey with the gorillas, and I'm so annoyed that I'm blanking on her name, with the orangutans. They were called Leakey's Angels. This is like before Charlie's Angels, they were Leakey's Angels. And they were ethologists and primatologists.
Beirut Galdikas? Is that her name? Am I getting her name?
Birute Galdikas is what it says here.
The orangutan lady.
I'm just gonna.
That's what Wikipedia says.
Listen, there's all
us.
These photos of her with orangutans. You know.
Yes, that's her. That's her. Yes. Sorry, I just pulled up the wiki page to supplement my faltering memory. Good old Fossey.
I had no idea. So there were three women who in media and popular culture whose names are switched around, because for a while, like, Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall's names were used interchangeably.
Yeah, no. they did similar work, but very different work.
Yeah, but it's that movie Gorillas in the Mist, you know, that sort of like nailed, get off my mountain, you know. And that sort of like influenced a lot of the people's concept of this idea of a person sort of living in isolation and studying cultures or nature.
I think with them, the field observations thing is a new development in ecology and primatology, because previous studies had mostly been done on like hunting expeditions or on zoo animals, which are not good test subjects for that sort of thing. You're not seeing the full spectrum of behavior, right? If you're hunting an animal, you've clearly got a different mindset and you're trying to stuff it and turn it into a specimen. If you're studying a zoo animal, that's not a natural environment. The animal's under stress, duress. It's not normal.
And why was Margaret Mead's, because especially in the early 90s and late 80s, Christian conservatives were always like, Margaret Mead this and Margaret Mead that. They always felt like they used her as a scapegoat about the liberalism in academia.
Yeah, Margaret Mead, there's a number of reasons why conservative Christians wouldn't like Margaret Mead. For one, she talks about, like, the sexuality of other cultures. In Samoa, apparently, it's more sexually permissive, or at least it was before Christian missionaries got to that particular group of people. She wrote about gender roles and sex in different tribal peoples in the South Pacific, the Arapesh, the Chimbri, and the Mundugmoor. I don't know. Again, I don't know how to pronounce any of these. the idea there is that both gender roles and sexuality are things that are culturally transmitted. In the Arapesh, she noted that men and women were both peaceful and neither men nor women really made war. They were like individual conflicts, but war as like a meme, as an innovation, wasn't there. The Chimbri had men who were very interested in magic, in their appearance, and in basically hiding secrets from women, because if they knew their secret names, they could steal their sorcery powers away. So the idea was that men, because of this, these secret male clicky things had this mystique to them that we would attribute to, say, witchcraft and women in our culture.
Sure. Because we're running out of time.
There's
so much stuff to cover. Ben Barnes, the famous transgender neuroscientist.
Ben Barnes is so amazing. Ben Barnes came to my attention in 2006 following the president of Harvard. Lawrence H. Summers in 2006 gave a very public speech about why there weren't women in science, and he attributed that to women being unable to science because brains. I'm paraphrasing, but it wasn't a great
when they run into problems, they start crying like Sally Ride did.
Yeah, because Sally Ride totally cried.
She was those O-rings.
Yeah, no, she... yeah, it's just nothing but tears there. Nothing but...
people were crying about that Challenger disaster. That really...
An emotional reaction to disaster is totally real, but, Sally Ride was a really level-headed person. So, Barnes, who had already transitioned, while he was at Stanford, took Summers to task in articles and interviews, right? I quote, "People are still arguing over whether there are cognitive differences between men and women. If they exist, it's not clear they are innate. And if they are innate, it's not clear they're relevant. They're subtle, and they might even benefit women. But when you tell people about the studies documenting bias, if they are prejudiced, they just discount the evidence." And he talks a lot about his life as a female scientist before he transitioned, right? So he's been acute, as a woman. When he, got the highest score on tests or did more research or better research than his counterparts, they would often accuse Barnes before the transition of cheating or give awards and grant money to the male scientists, right? So he's like, no, the reason why women don't succeed is because they're driven out. And I've seen literally both sides. And Barnes isn't just doing fantastic research on Alzheimer's and the role of glial cells in neuron and synapse formation, really complicated, really intense research. He's advocating for female students and LGBT students in his professional life, which is something that's actually quite hard to do as a scientist, because there's still this prevailing thing in modern academia, especially the sciences and engineering, that if you do anything that's not science, you are unserious and uncommitted, right? Mm. People don't talk about their hobbies. They don't talk about their spouses, their kids. or their sexualities because it's seen as something that's not professional.
Well, they also feel like it draws attention away from their work. That's
another problem too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on top of that, you have an incredibly competitive granting structure that tends to be overseen by the previous generation of scientists who might not be public about their biases, but probably have them. So there's nested problems with being both a woman and being open as an LGBT person in modern research.
Especially if you're transgender, you know.
It's really bad.
Yeah, and so for the vast majority of the people we talked on today's show, it's a lot of them are sort of, put aside their identities, their desires, and really in the quest of making the world a better place and in the pursuit of knowledge.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part about investigating LGBT history, or really the history of any marginalized group, is that you have to deal with either the burying or sublimation of that part of themselves, that identity, or you have to deal with them fighting direct discrimination and public discrimination because of something they can't hide.
Last but not least, the movie The Imitation Game has drawn a lot of attention to LGBT scientists, most famously Alan Turing, the mathematician and sort of the founder of the modern computer. How accurate was that movie to his actual life? I mean, did he commit suicide? Was he murdered?
Well, do we know, really?
Oh, Lord. So Turing in The Imitation Game is like gay in like name only, in that like it's never mentioned the reason why Turing was put on trial. It's never mentioned that like he had an ongoing relationship while he was at Bletchley Park, and that's the reason he was eventually brought up on sodomy charges, right? And it's never mentioned that he was sentenced to chemical castration. So like.
And at the time period, chemical castration meant suppressing your testosterone, or what was it exactly?
Oh, God. I don't know how they chemically castrated people. I just know that they gave you a cocktail of drugs to, like, supposedly remove your potency and suppress your sex drive.
And I guess, God, the TV commercials alone today, they're like, you know, male rejuvenation formulas, all this stuff.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
It's all basically that now everybody understands. A lot of people realize now today, and it's I guess it's a consensus that if you stop somebody's hormones, regardless of their gender identity, that you're really messing with their mental well-being.
Yeah. And that it couldn't have done any favors to Turing's mental or physical health. Mm-hmm. So in this Imitation Game movie, it's really doing a disservice to Turing as a gay man, which is like okay only if you're focusing on Turing as a code breaker, but all the Oscar buzz around the movie centered around him being gay. The Human Rights Coalition got involved, the Weinstein Company played up the gay thing, and advocated for the posthumous pardoning of the 49,000 people prosecuted and convicted under the gross indecency law that Turing was prosecuted under. And like, that's just really disingenuous. If you're going to make a movie about a gay man, and you're going to make a movie about his life, and you're going to Oscar bait it with like the horrendous prejudice he faced, mm-hmm. and the, you know, persecution he received for what he was, then you need to include that shit in the movie.
It was kind of subtext, yeah. Really. I mean, you see he has this relationship in school with this young boy named Christopher, and then you find out that's what he names the his computer, Christopher, after him. So the world's first computer was gay?
I guess. That's cool. Computers don't have feelings yet.
Well, it was named after somebody he was in love with, you know. Mm-hmm. And right, so, but like, that's not
That's a tribute, sure, but like, it's not a full realization of Turing as a gay person, right? And if I don't know.
Wait, like, do you feel like it would have been good if he sort of they had an extended karaoke segment in the movie? I mean, was Alan Turing not kind of a square kind of guy anyways? I mean, it's not like he was pretty, like, you know, going to drag shows in the UK, was he?
I mean, he was pretty square because of the requirements that he was under, because he was part of the German, the British intelligence apparatus. Yeah. Like, you needed to be very careful about your personal life so that, like, counter spies wouldn't find out crap about you and then use that to blackmail you into revealing secrets. It was a practice called honeypotting, right? So it's something that was done a lot in, like, West versus Soviet spy craft, but it wasn't something that was still done.
That's still being done to this day on multiple levels. It's like putting up things that for people to inadvertently trip over in order to get a lawsuit or to lose their jobs, and it's, you know.
Right, but like, you know, I still would have liked to have seen like the character of Arnold Murray, his actual lover at the time, shown in the movie. Right, because like otherwise it's just Alan Turing wistfully looking back on like a childhood crush he had. That's kind of a
it's a constant in the way LGBT characters and people are depicted in films as sort of like, you know, pining over lost love as opposed to sort of developing their interpersonal relationships mostly. You know, it's like more famously the movie Carol, which is not about Horatio Sanz's Saturday Night Live character, but
I want a Dunkin' Donuts coffee cooler.
No, but the movie Carol is sort of a exemplifies that. It's about a woman who never really fully gets to get the relationship that she's seeking, right? And I think that with Alan Turing and you know, if you made a movie, I mean, Vincent, you have a book here. This extraordinary research that you did for this podcast, and I'm not kidding. Like, hit up a publisher and get some money out of this, because it's really an extraordinary contribution you did to our audience, and it really, I feel like we just scratched the surface here.
Oh God, I pulled up so much more stuff than we had time to cover. I had no idea how long your podcast would go or how long you would interview for. I figured that like there would be like an over interview and we'd edit stuff out as we went. I don't know.
It's more fun if it's a little more organic, don't you think?
Oh yeah, totally.
And you know, cause I don't want to interrupt the chemistry.
Yeah, we've
established. Thank you for the puns.
Yes, of course.
You're welcome. So in terms of LGBT people in the science fields of science today, with so much, you know, visibility and awareness, you know, certainly we know, personally, and a lot of people in the scientific fields that are very open about their experiences and see it as an asset and no longer as a liability. Is that the case everywhere, or are there some fields that are more restrictive than others?
So in terms of like most accepting to least accepting, biology tends to be a more accepting field of LGBT people and women than other fields, because at biology is really close to gender parity. It's like 53% women, 47% men at this point. But like when you get to say engineering, physics, and math, it gets way, way worse. So
my bisexual sister, Talia Fernos, she's a big deal in the world of math.
That's really
I just
good.
I outed her. I don't know if she's.
Oh no!
No, I'm just kidding. Oh, she's well. She doesn't care. She's like.
Edit it out. Yeah. I don't know who the editor is, but edit it out. No outing people on the podcast.
Well, she's my sister, and she's very public about her sexual and experience. But you know, and I asked her about this. I was like, "What is it like in the field?" And she said, "You know, in some ways, is actually a lot of people are coming forward." Because schools are seeking diversity and places that are hiring, they want intentionally to have people from a vast variety of perspectives and cultures and experiences, because ultimately that makes their field of study much richer.
Which is totally true. It's just a matter of making sure all of the fields catch up to that, right? Because it's still kind of a fraught issue. Like, if you're, say, a graduate student or a postdoc, someone who's working for very little money and is kind of tenuously under the control of a established scientist, it's a lot harder to be out. It's a lot harder to be open. It's only people who have, like, it's usually people who have a lot of publications, a lot of grant money, who have the luxury of, like, always being out. Because at that point, they're established and nothing that they do is going to be seen as, like, something weird, barring something criminal.
Well, yeah, and if you are the son of a wealthy Prussian family today, you would just go to circuit parties. You wouldn't sort of, like, cultivate a whole new field of study.
If I were a wealthy Prussian person today, I would be a historical anomaly because Prussia was absorbed into the greater state of Germany. But I would also still do science because, by God, it's way more fun to, like, dig up dinosaur bones and name stuff after yourself and, like, see, like, and, like, get kids excited about things than it is to, like, do a bunch of drugs and, like, pass out unconscious somewhere, at least for me. Maybe I'm not very much fun to party with.
you're great to talk to, Vincent. Two questions that I never ever feel like I ever got to know the answer, and this is more about women in science. And I don't know if you're familiar with this. Mary Anning, she was a young girl who discovered one of the first fossils of an ichthyosaurus, which kind of looks like a dolphin lizard.
Yes, I'm very much aware of her.
What happened to her?
She is one of my homegirls, sort of, historically speaking. Yeah. I would go out with her, like, drink, because she definitely would have needed it.
She was fun to be around.
Mary Anning was one of the founding people in paleontology. She lived in, I think, Devonshire in England. And she was, like, instrumental in our understanding of paleontology. She did discover the first intact ichthyosaur fossil and reconstructed it. She also was responsible for discovering 5-10 other extinct species, and all of her discoveries were bought by people who belonged to the Royal Society of London, and she never got credit for anything. She was never admitted into the Royal Society or the Geological Society because she was a woman. And because she was born to a working class family, it was only after she died, after a long struggle with breast cancer, that they felt guilty and eternally memorialized her in the local church by purchasing a gigantic stained glass window with her and her fossils on it. You've heard that nursery rhyme, "She sells seashells by the seashore."
Oh, yeah.
Mary Anning is that she. She is the origin of that nursery rhyme.
Oh, I had no idea. That's fantastic. You know, my friends and I picked up on that story back in the early 90s, and we just became obsessed with her.
There was a point in college where I was so obsessed with her, I literally wrote a sestina about her. A sestina is a 16-line, or sorry, I think it's not 16-line. It's like a 6-stanza Italian poem form where you remix words in different orders. It was an intensely nerdy thing of me to do.
Now, and I want to quickly touch on Ada Lovelace, who hackers call the first hacker in history.
Yeah, she was really cool.
So she programmed, I guess, the Babbage analytical engine.
With punch cards, I think.
And I guess the reason they did it is so they could figure out horse races. They were like compulsive gamblers.
Yeah, it was primarily about figuring out how to bet optimally.
Oh wow!
Although I have to admit, I didn't get into the Ada Lovelace story as much because I didn't know we'd be talking about her.
No, I just wanted to bring it up because I've always been fascinated with these two women, and you're the only person that I know that I could actually talk. Because I guess she was the daughter of English poet Lord Byron.
Yep, yep. And she grew up in a house of, like, moping angst and poetic imagery, and she was, like, the hardest mathematician ever.
And she liked to drink and gamble, and she was a party animal.
Oh yeah, totally.
You know, she was a woman of loose morals, as they would say.
Hell yeah.
I imagine after living with Lord Byron my entire life as a child, I'd just be like, fuck it. I'm partying. I'm doing tons of math. I'm going to find Lord Babbage. I'm going to program a goddamn computer before it's called a computer. And I'm going to live my life. You know, like,
did you ever, do you know, or I wonder if anybody who's listening to this right now, how good was she at figuring out the horse races?
Oh, God.
Like, was she successful at it? Or
I honestly do not know.
Well, I have one little piece of science trivia for you.
Good.
Did you know WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, is inspired by a drag queen?
I don't know what WYSIWYG is.
WYSIWYG is it's a term in the early 90s to describe web design.
Yeah.
So when we used to code with HTML websites, you didn't always see what you got, mm-hmm. right? And right. so there was a lot of software being developed that allowed coders to see what they got, and hence the term what you see, WYSIWYG, or what you see is what you get. And that comes from...
from Geraldine. Yeah. Flip Wilson's drag character. She used to say, what you see is what you get. Because people were always looking at her dressed in drag going, I don't know what's going on. So, but yeah, WYSIWYG is what the computer engineers designate a text editing system that appears on screen much as it will appear in print.
So. And Geraldine influenced RuPaul. Mm-hmm. And in the movie Star Booty, the institute, the school.
Film.
One of the greatest films of all time, Star Booty, mm-hmm. takes place at the Tuskegee Technical Institute of George Washington Carver.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a weird connection we've got here.
I know, right?
Oh, yeah. We're
full of weird connections here.
I'm sorry I hadn't heard of WYSIWYG, because that's way before my time.
Well, you know, WYSIWYG it's one of those things that I want to say, if you do kind of web design, even up, and you don't hear it so much. I'd probably say around 2005 or 6 is probably when it kind of dropped out of the vernacular. But like well into the century, people would talk about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's still a term that's being tossed around in coding and design, but it's not as sort of people now expect thing to be able to control the way web pages look. But at the time period, you had multiple computer platforms and different fonts installed, and not everybody had Times or Arial or Helvetica on their computer.
It's before Squarespace, before the dawn of Squarespace, yeah. And a vast sea of teeming millions.
Before the dawn of MySpace, even. I remember when MySpace started, and it was like considered to be the end-all be-all for music promotion.
There, you know what? It's just before space. It's before any space has existed.
We should call this Feast Space. Feast of space. Fun Space.
So, Vincent, tell me, you just recently left writing for ourcityforest.org that hosted the blog entry about Alexander von Humboldt. Where's your life and your career as a science historian and a lover of trees going?
Well, I finished that off because it was an AmeriCorps thing. Have you heard of AmeriCorps?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That most people tell me no, and they give me a blank stare, and then
Bill
they stare
Clinton
through me.
Started it in 1992.
Totally, yeah, he totally did. It's a domestic peace corps. So, I mean, that term's over. And now what I'm doing is I'm applying to science journalism schools. So I'm like looking at, like, say, MIT science writing, and I'm looking at a bunch of other places to try to make this into a thing that I do because I really enjoy doing it.
Well, yeah. I feel like you have a book here, and certainly, you know, we scratch the surface with this extraordinary podcast. There's a lot of great information. I know it sounds like a cliche, but if you want to learn more about LGBT scientists, check out your local library.
The more you know.
Vincent, it's a pleasure talking to you. Where can people sort of contact you who want to collaborate with you or pick your brain more on the extraordinary world of LGBT science?
You can find me on Queerica.com, or you can find me at Vincent D. Gabriel on Twitter.
Wonderful. So we'll put up links to that. And thank you so much for taking the time to talking to us. I really, really got a lot of joy out about this extraordinary show. I've been wanting to do this for so long.
You know, I've been wanting to do this for so long too. It drove me crazy how like awkward it was trying to schedule this. It's like, oh no, it's never going to happen. And it's really nice to have it happen.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Vincent.
Sometimes these podcasts are months in the making.
Yeah, we've been working on this for about 3 months now, right?
Yeah, we've been doing this since like mid-August-ish.
And I actually was working on a show about George Washington Carver, and then I just stumbled upon your blog entry. I'm like, this guy...
Von Humboldt, Mark. Do you know about Von Humboldt?
I was excited about that. It's just a great, and people, if you can read the article of why is everything named Von Humboldt, is really extraordinary.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to hear you say that.
Tell you a funny story about Humboldt Park here in Chicago. We went to get our transmission fixed on the south side of Chicago because everything on the south side, mechanic-wise, is like cheaper than the north side. So we go in, there, and the woman running the joints is Puerto Rican woman who lives in Humboldt Park. And she's just like, they have, do you speak Spanish?
Not really, no. Not really, I'm sorry.
Okay. So maybe you won't get the joke as much. But they have a beach in this park. It's a public little beach. So they dug a little lake in there and they made a beach there because it's not very close to Lake Michigan. So they wanted to give something for people to go. And she goes, and it's called Mahoney Beach. And like, I was like, okay. And so she's just like, and the reason why it's called Mahoney Beach is because you go in there and like you'll see a beach of Mahoney floating around. And Mahoney in Spanish.
Mahones.
Is poop in Spanish.
Oh my God.
They call it Poop Beach.
I'm flashing back to a conversation I had with my grandfather growing up in the north end of Boston. And he's like, yeah, we would go swimming out in Boston Harbor and we would just dodge the turds. And I'd be like, Jesus.
Yeah, back in the day, it was like raw sewage ruled the land.
Gross.
Can we attribute Humboldt's work to our sort of an understanding of the fact that you got to keep the parks and beaches clean? It's like
I think that's actually the work of it's not Lister. There's an English epidemiologist who figured out that
Listerine. Like,
no, Lister, yeah, that's actually Listerine. He figured out sterilization in surgical equipment, Dr. Lister. Really important. They didn't do that before, hence gangrene. But there's another guy who figured out that you could trace infections back to fecal contamination in wells in London because there was a typhoid epidemic, and I'm blanking on his name. It's going to drive me insane. Then we're going to hang up this podcast, and then I'm going to remember it. And I'm going to text it to you in all caps.
Well, you know, the best way to get the audience or the internet is to respond with the information you're seeking is to come up with a completely wrong answer and pass it off as fact.
Oh, because they love to tell you you're wrong.
To correct you.
It was probably Queen Elizabeth.
It probably was. She was the Queen Scat Elizabeth. Queen, they called her.
Yeah, the Queen of Scat. She rode upon her horse, who was named Dookie. And discovered
if I shit in this well, they'll all get sick.
Vincent, it's a pleasure chatting with you. Really, I urge you or anybody who's listening to this to further explore and expand this field of research of sort of telling the story of LGBT people through their contributions in science, because it really is. It's a great story and it's great information.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed doing it, and I'll continue to enjoy doing it because I'm not going to stop. I'll just keep compiling these.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Vincent.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Vincent Gabriel lives in San Jose, California. We're going to put up links on our website, feastoffun.com, to his extraordinary article about Alexander von Humboldt. And you can see pictures of a lot of these extraordinary LGBT scientists on our website, feastoffun.com.
And who's your favorite queer scientist? We want to know. You can leave a comment on this blog post entry. What are we titling this? Queer Science?
Queer Science. Science.
You blinded me with queer science.
Yes. We expanded our minds with queer science.
I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, consider signing up today at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to this show is what makes this show happen. We really, really can't do it without you.
We're doing this show ad-free, and it only happens because of your financial support. Consider making a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate or shop in our chic boutique at feastoffun.com/store. What an amazing show. I'm going to, like, at the end of it, just start at the beginning and listen to it all over again. What a great show. This is like a combination of several of my favorite things. LGBT history.
Cosmos.
Carl Sagan. George Washington Carver.
Peanuts.
Peanut butter.
All of it.
Let's read one more time George Washington Carver's extraordinary quote, because I want to leave you guys with this.
Okay.
This is a man who, he would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning every single day and go into the woods and talk with God. There, George Washington Carver said, God gave him his orders for the day. Alone there with the things I love most, I gathered specimens and studied the great lessons nature was so eager to teach us all. When people are still asleep, that's when I hear God best and learn my plan. How do I talk to a little flower? Through it, I talk to the infinite. And what is the infinite? It is the silent small force. It isn't the outer physical contact. No, it isn't that. The infinite is not confined in the visible world. It is not in the earthquake, the wind, or the fire. The infinite is that still small voice that calls up the fairies. Thank you guys so much for listening. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.